Here in Tucson. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Tamari A. Studio, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Tune in throughout the week as we continue to bring you our series, Death and Resistance on the U.S.-Mexico Border. I'm Amy Goodman in Tucson, Arizona. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBO Portland, time is 5 o'clock.
The programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Tuesday of each month at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Unity, a night of feminist Latinx BDX hip-hop, Tuesday, August 28th at 9 p.m. at the Dogfer Lounge in Portland. Unity features artists Maria Advertencia Lirica from Oaxaca, Valentina Peralta from Chile, Portland's Kayla J, and DJ La Pausi. This event is also sponsored by Colectivo Ruda and Cup Hub Creative. Again, la mula no era arisca, pero la hicieron. That's Unity, a night of feminist Latinx BDX hip-hop, Tuesday, August 28th at 9 p.m. at the Dogfer Lounge, 830 E. Burnside Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Sweet Creek Foods, family-owned and operated in Elmira, Oregon, sourcing local organic ingredients and supporting Pacific Northwest farmers and fishermen. Offering organic products including salsas, pickles, jams, tomato, and enchilada sauces, and Oregon albacore tuna packaged in sustainable glass. More information including product locator map at sweetcreekfoods.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, eyewitness reports from Saturday's protest in downtown Portland.
Tech companies are accused of overextending their contractors.
And at our News In Depth segment, a conversation with the founder and the programming director of Rose City Comic Con.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 19th, 2019. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Ethan Fry. This past Saturday, far-right groups and anti-fascist counter-protesters met in Portland's Tom McCall Waterfront Park in a much-anticipated protest clash. The Proud Boys, about 300 in total, were widely outnumbered by the over 1,000 counter-protesters. Police made 13 arrests for civil disturbance. The crowd control tactics and lack of violence at the protest were a point of pride for state and city officials. Billy J. Williams, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Oregon, said of law enforcement at the protest, quote, "They do not and cannot take sides in a politically charged public discourse. This weekend's response effort was consistent with what I've observed throughout my career, public servants working together to ensure public safety and help others, irrespective of politics." For more on the story, KBOO's Althea Billings spoke to Sean Stevens, an eyewitness at the protest.
I mean, they're just 10 police officers over here, and I thought that was really surprising, but I felt really, like, exposed a little bit because there was no one else there. But
so, Sean, why don't you recount to me what your experience was at the protest on Saturday?
So I had shown up pretty early. I didn't know that it was supposed to start at 11 o'clock, so I got there about 9 o'clock. I had parked on the east side, and so I kind of was walking around and was there as things were kind of building up. And it was pretty apparent to, I think, everybody that, you know, the north side was going to be locals and anti-protesters, and the south side was going to be the Proud Boys. So I was there, and I decided that I, you know, was going to try to be up front as much as possible. And so, like, the riot police had their line held up there under the bridge, and basically as things kind of after 11 o'clock, as things, you know, were kind of heating up, you could see there was a bunch of American flags kind of being walked around on the other side. The police kind of charged real quick and got everybody back out of the street. And right at that same moment, a news reporter was talking to his film guy or his cameraman, and told them, hey, the Proud Boys are moving south. The Proud Boys are moving south. And so I wasn't there with anybody, and I thought, well, shoot, maybe I'll just follow these guys for a second. But it got pretty crazy with the police backing everybody up at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was following them to go south, that's when you could see that the Proud Boys were being escorted across the bridge. And two people in front of me said, that's really odd that, you know, everybody knew that the bridge was closed and nobody has a permit to have a protest, and why are the police escorting them across the bridge? And then it looked like the police just kind of let everybody go towards the bridge. And I thought, oh man, they're not going to let them go, you know, following them. So I went back around to the other side, where I crossed over the Burnside Bridge, and I looked up in the air and I saw that the only police helicopter that was kind of surveying the area was actually over by the OMSI parking lot. So I figured, perfect, that's got to be where they are. So I went running down the bike trail. Once I kind of got to the OMSI parking lot area, I mean, I just walked right into the middle of all their, pretty much the end of the rally. And so I just kind of decided, you know, I didn't want to do anything too aggressive. So I just kind of put two thumbs down. And, you know, I started kind of just walking through the crowd, and I'm, you know, the only person there. And the one thing I noticed is there was maybe, 10 cops on their side for, you know, this entire thing that I had just witnessed over on the west side of the river. It was full riot police. I mean, they were doing procedures. They're hanging off the side of the car, and I have 10 police officers with yellow t-shirts on, and they had helmets on, but, I mean, they're just 10 police officers over here, and I thought that was really surprising, but I felt really, like, exposed a little bit because there was no one else there. But I just started walking through the crowd a little bit. People started yelling things like, good thing you have the, you know, your right of the freedom of speech because we're the ones that gave it to you. Kind of held my ground, and I just kind of had my thumbs down. And after about 2 minutes, about six police officers just came over, and they told me that I was being an agitator. And I mean, I could understand what they were saying. And I asked them, I said, I'm standing in the street. If I stand on the sidewalk, can I stay here? And they said, look, you're really agitating the situation. And I just looked back, I said, you're being respectful, I'll be respectful. So I didn't want to leave because I didn't see anybody else filming anything over here. And so I kind of just hung around in the back, and now I've been there for maybe 10 minutes at the most. And they said, all right, everybody, that's it. And they broke up the rally, and about half of them left. But there's a few really interesting things that I noticed after. Like, well, one, there was a lot of cars. They had already all pre-parked at where they had crossed over, and you just go down a set of stairs, and there's a parking lot right there by OMSI. And then they went over to kind of one corner, and they were hanging out. And that's when I saw somebody I recognized from the rally on the other side. And when I was up front with the police, not with the police, but, you know, face-to-face with the police, there was a guy who's, you know, over 6'5", 6'7". I mean, he just looks like this gladiator-style guy. He's full riot gear. And so as I'm standing across at the end of the Proud Boys rally back over on their side, there he comes up with about six other people, all with black shirts on and bandanas and all the riot gear. And they had been all down there and everything, and this was all the Proud Boys' friends. And they were like, oh, you know, welcoming them back and whatnot. And so, legitimately, they just had some huge people over there in full, you know, to say Antifa gear, basically, riot mask, you know, chest protector and everything. And I just couldn't believe that, you know, I felt like, one, they had implanted people over there, and then the other part, they didn't accidentally end up on that side of the river. It just seemed weird that the police worked with out-of-towners and then against the basically the local people of the city.
That was KBOO's Althea Billings in conversation with Sean Stevens, an eyewitness at Saturday's protest in downtown Portland.
Alpenrose Dairy recently announced the sale of their business to Smith Brothers Farms in Kent, Washington. The sale could be finalized in 30 days. Earlier in the year, the great-great-grandchildren of Alpenrose founder Florian Cadenau sued their relatives over plans to sell the company. The lawsuit was settled, and the dairy supposedly taken off the market until the most recent announcement. Alpenrose is located on 50 acres of land in southwest Portland. The dairy hosts events, bike races, games, and a farm. Many residents, local residents, participate in these events. It's still unclear what will happen to the company's 150 employees.
Beginning today, Portland police officers will join law enforcement agencies to educate the public about safety belt and child seat laws. The goal is to increase the safety of children in vehicles. Vehicle crashes are the leading cause of death for children ages 1 to 12 years old in the nation. In 2017, almost 2,000 children under 12 were injured in Oregon car crashes. In 2017, an Oregon law required children to ride in a rear-facing seat until they are 2 years old. A child over 2 must ride in a car seat until they're 8 years old. To find a local child seat fitting station near you and to learn more, you can visit OregonImpact.org.
5 years after the death of Eric Garner was captured on video, the officer responsible for his death was fired from the New York Police Department today. Since 2014, former officer Danielle Pantaleo waited to learn whether he could remain on the force. After trials in May and June, Deputy Commissioner of Trials Rosemary Maldonado recommended the removal of Pantaleo. Pantaleo was on desk duty while collecting an annual salary, according to public records. However, he was suspended after the judge's recommendation. Judge Maldonado ruled that Pantaleo used the prohibited chokehold that caused Garner's death, and Pantaleo must be immediately terminated. The video of Garner was seen by millions. His last words were, quote, "I can't breathe," which became a rallying cry for organizations such as Black Lives Matter against police-involved deaths.
Senator Bernie Sanders yesterday became the first 2020 presidential candidate to endorse a ban on law enforcement's use of facial recognition technology. The proposed ban is a part of a massive criminal justice system overhaul proposed by the Vermont senator, which would change many of the nation's laws and rules for police departments and courts. The 6,000-word proposal calls for an end to private prisons and detention facilities, the legalization of marijuana, and an end to the war on drugs. The proposal mandates the Attorney General to begin an investigation any time a person is killed in police custody and would establish a prisoner's bill of rights, which would include a ban on solitary confinement and abolish the death penalty. The proposal also seeks to establish a civilian corps of first responders to deal with the mental health emergencies and provides medical help for people suffering from opioid addiction. Critics view the plan as overly ambitious, and it is expected to be rejected by police unions across the nation.
California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill today that changes the standard for police officers' use of deadly force from instances when it's reasonable to necessary. Newsom says the new law will reduce the number of lives lost and will help heal communities. The law changes the way police can resort to deadly force and encourages the use of de-escalation techniques. The changes in this law were advocated by organizations like Black Lives Matter after an unarmed black man was gunned down by a police officer in Sacramento. According to the Civil Liberties Union, the law contains the strongest language in any state.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News on Monday, August 19th, 2019. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO's News in Depth. We'll be talking to Ron Breiter and Mikey Nyalin of Rose City Comic Con. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is mostly clear with a low of 59. Tomorrow's weather is mostly cloudy with temperatures between 60 and 85. Today in history, in 1909, the first race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway was held, which is now home to the world's most viewed racing competition, the Indianapolis 500. The quote of today is from Fred Lebow, the founder of the New York City Marathon. It doesn't matter whether you come in first, in the middle of the pack, or last. You can say, I have finished. There's a lot of satisfaction in that.
Federal regulators today approved Delta Airlines' plans for nonstop flights from Portland to the Tokyo Haneda Airport. The Port of Portland and Delta Airlines announced the flights will begin next spring. 11 other cities established new connections to the airport as well. The routes are in preparation for the 2020 Summer Olympics in Japan. Delta already had flights from Portland to Tokyo Narita Airport, but that's located about 50 miles from Haneda. Haneda is closer to downtown and will cut travel times to the heart of Tokyo by 1 hour. This will expand flights to 7 days per week instead of five. Flights should take 11 hours to Japan and 9 hours back to Portland.
At 3 a.m. today, the Salem Fire Department battled a commercial fire that burned at Oregon Pallet, an industrial complex. Firefighters from Silverton, Woodburn, Kaiser, and other districts assisted at the scene. The blaze was quickly contained. The fire ripped through hundreds of wood pallets and destroyed equipment. Corey Ryan, a truck driver at Oregon Pallet, said, quote, "There are 10 trucks parked in the corner that are melted down to frames. There's a wood grinder, excavator, a chip den. Total waste. Just melted destruction." No one was hurt and no employees were inside. The cause of the fire is still unknown.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. 9 Democratic presidential hopefuls and 1 independent candidate are expected to take part in a 2-day forum starting Monday with Marianne Williamson and Senator Elizabeth Warren. They'll be followed in the afternoon by Senator Amy Klobuchar and Governor Steve Bullock. Organizers of the Frank LaMare Native American Presidential Forum in Sioux City, Iowa, say the event is intended to bring Native issues to the forefront. The group, Four Directions, is a leading organizer. At a press conference over the weekend, the group's co-director, O.J. Siemens, said the event is not a debate, but an educational opportunity for the candidates and the public.
First of all, voting is a foundation of all of our problems. If we're not involved in the political process, our treaties, our sovereignty, housing, health care, all of that.
Siemens said the issues important to Native Americans start with participating in the political process.
If an individual knows our issues and stuff and can talk about it, that's fine. If they don't, then let us educate them. This is not anything except for we're inviting people into our home. We're dealing with not only the possible next president up here, we're also dealing with cabinet members that are going to be working one way or another with tribes.
Each candidate is given 1 hour to engage in dialogue with a panel of tribal leaders, elders, and youth to discuss issues impacting tribal communities across the United States. Topics are expected to include missing and murdered indigenous women, energy development, and the environment. The forum continues Tuesday with Mark Charles, an independent candidate and Navajo citizen, former Congressman John Delaney, former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro, Mayor Bill de Blasio, and Senators Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has filed a motion for summary judgment in its ongoing battle against the Dakota Access Pipeline. The tribe said the brief outlines how the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers violated federal environmental law by failing to meaningfully respond to the tribe's concerns. The tribe wants to vacate an easement that allowed for pipeline construction. That would halt operations and require an environmental review by the Corps. Voice of America reports the tribe is also pushing back against plans by the pipeline's operator, Energy Transfer Partners, to double the 500 million barrels of oil flowing through the pipeline daily. The tribe has requested that the North Dakota Public Service Commission hold a hearing on the proposed expansion. Energy Partners has maintained DAPL was, quote, built to be one of the safest pipelines in the world. It has also pledged to work closely with local, state, and federal authorities during planned upgrades. Meanwhile, Bloomberg reports oil and chemical companies, including Energy Transfer Partners, have lobbied state legislatures to outlaw demonstrations near pipelines. 9 states have passed measures that criminalize trespassing near so-called critical infrastructure. That includes pipelines and gas processing equipment. There's a push to get them passed in Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Ohio as well. In California, 3 officials of the Pascenta Band of Nomlaki Indians pled guilty to engaging in conspiracy to embezzle millions of dollars from the tribe and related tax fraud. The Sacramento Bee reported the tribe runs the Rolling Hills Casino. A 2017 indictment laid out what it called a 12-year looting spree to embezzle $6 million that prosecutors said was used to buy homes, cars, gold coins, and overseas trips. The 3 defendants initially denied the charges, and a trial was scheduled for next month. But on Thursday, John Crosby, a former FBI agent who was also once the tribe's economic development director, entered a guilty plea, along with his mother, Ines Crosby, the former tribal administrator, and Leslie Loesch, sister to Ines Crosby. Sentencing is scheduled for January 30th. A lawsuit against the 3 by the tribe is still pending. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Smartphone users want to fix their broken iPhone. Taking it to an unauthorized repair shop could void the warranty. That all could change since 20 states are considering the Right to Repair bill. The Federal Trade Commission is asking for comments on whether people should be able to get their electronics fixed by a third party. Last year, Apple warned customers about getting a new iPhone battery installed by a third party. The company claimed that they wanted to, quote, protect our customers from damaged, poor quality, or the use of batteries which can lead to safety or performance issues. According to CNET senior managing editor Dan Ackerman, Apple's motives are to drive people to Apple or Apple-authorized repair shops that charge Apple-level prices. The Right to Repair law would require companies to provide parts and the needed software and manuals.
Jewel may be to blame for the lung injury of 18-year-old Chance Amarada. Last week, emergency room doctors told Amarada his right lung had a hole in it and had collapsed. According to Amarada, "I just freaked out. They said your lung had collapsed. You have to go to surgery right now." Amarada's surgeon told CBS News that Amarada's lungs were inflamed, a result of something he was inhaling. Amarada started using Juul e-cigarettes a year ago when he was 16. He believes Juul caused the injury. Recently, Amarada started a social media hashtag called #LungLove to help others get rid of their Juuls. Thousands have participated. One message said, quote, "You inspired me to stop, as well as many other teenagers. I used to vape for about 2 years now, and I have finally decided to stop." Doctors told CBS News the vaping contributed to a small pocket in Amarada's lung blowing out. Juul declined to comment on the case. However, they're monitoring the reports on other lung injuries.
Russia's state nuclear agency admitted today that two nuclear workers were killed in an explosion, resulting from a rocket engine test in northern Russia on August 8th. The explosion caused a spike in radiation nearby and prompted local run on iodine, which was used to reduce the effects of radiation exposure. On August 10th, two sites that monitor radiation levels in the region mysteriously went offline, prompting some to accuse the state of tampering. Russian authorities have given no official explanation as to why the blast triggered a rise in radiation or why the monitoring sites have gone offline, but some suspect Russia was testing a new nuclear-powered cruise missile that was mentioned by President Vladimir Putin in a speech last year. These events come soon after President Trump refused to renew the Intermediate Nuclear Arms Treaty, which had been in place since 1987. The treaty, which served to limit nuclear missile proliferation in nuclear in Russia and the U.S., formally ended on August 2nd. New talks have not yet been scheduled.
A recent senatorial letter shed light on an issue facing workers in a multitude of companies across the tech industry. Temporary workers and independent contractors still lack the same benefits as full-time employees. KBOO's Ethan Fry has more on the story.
The tech industry has revolutionized how people live, and it would be shocking for someone to not know what a computer or the internet was. In contrast, the plight of the workers behind the very device you are listening to this broadcast on is hidden. 10 U.S. senators have urged Google to stop abuses of its independent contractors, and are arguing for benefits equivalent to those of full-time employees. According to a senatorial letter written in July, quote, "The differences between full-time employees and contractors appears to be in name only. Google determines where these individuals work, the hours they work, and the tasks they perform. They commonly work on permanent projects alongside full-time Google employees for years, typically at much lower pay. These independent contractors are hardly independent, and Google readily abuses them. At the company, there are more independent contractors than there are full-time employees." The letter continues that, quote, "Google is valued at more than $100 billion, and their CEO's personal compensation topped $400 million in 2018, which makes it that much more difficult to stomach the mistreatment of these workers." Google's vice president of people operations responded to the letter, disputing both the overall claim and specific statistics. Quote, "Respectfully, we strongly disagree with any suggestion that Google misuses independent contractors or temporary workers." She continued that the company's practices accord with the highest industry standards. Whether or not this is true, it appears that Google is not ready to change. However, this problem is not confined solely to Google. Other tech companies such as Facebook, Amazon, and Netflix regularly face similar accusations, and the motivation to utilize temps is an issue of how the industry functions. Glenn Hinton, a former senior fellow at Intel, elaborated on these motivations in an interview I conducted with him last week.
What I've seen more often is sometimes I've known some groups who hired some temps, and the main reason why they would hire temps is temps often didn't count against their headcount budget. So they've got a budget from the corporate office, what, how many people can be employed in their group. And if they were at their limit, they couldn't hire any more people. But they could hire temps, just because temps didn't count against their headcount goals. And when you hire a temp, it's not a commitment to keep that individual, right? It's a temp. So that's why temps are viewed differently. I mean, they probably cost less because sometimes they may or may not have full health care.
These factors that motivate the employment of temps are not just limited to blue-collar type jobs. Today, the fastest growth in contract work is in white-collar roles. Economists Lawrence Katz and Alan Krueger found that jobs in higher wages are more likely to have their services contracted out than jobs associated with lower wages. With the surge of tech firms and over a third of the American workforce now freelancing, independent contractors and other temporary workers will require more protections. A start would be to apply the recommendations from the Senate, even to just a few companies. The faster action is taken, the more effective it will be. For example, Intel already converts one-year temps into full-time employees, a practice which is recommended by the senators. And although helpful, the policy has flaws of its own that once again come down to how the tech industry works.
Some of the temps that I knew worked there, they worked full-time and they got benefits. So to them, temps were, they can work for 1 year, and after 1 year, they have to either be converted into a full-time, you know, employee that continues, or be let go. I knew there are a couple of people who were in that situation where they were converted to a full-time employee, or there's somebody else that they just had to let go, even though they wanted to keep the person because the person was doing a good job. But they have to have a slot
available for the employment.
They have to have an opening for a full-time employee.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes they don't have any. So no matter how much they like them, they can't.
So it's an issue of bounds of the company, right? How many people they can be employing, how many people they can be employing in a specific area.
So, and oftentimes, see, at least at Intel, and I don't agree how they did this oftentimes, but sometimes the only throttle mechanism they had at the corporate level was budgeting headcount. That was really the only way they could stop a group from getting bigger than they wanted that group to be. And so they might, when a group wanted to grow and hire 20 people the next year, they might let them have 3. Or they might say, oh, by the way, you have to lose 5. By the end of the year, you have to lose 5 people.
And do you think there's a better way to manage that than just doing what they're currently doing, or do you think it's the most feasible way?
I didn't like how it worked out many times. What would have worked better is if they could have said, you have this many dollars. Spend them however you want. And whether it's on full-time heads or temps or through whatever means you have, fine. But that's not how Intel usually did it.
Unfortunately, the problem of temporary employment status, which began because of corporate inefficiency and greed, is hard to fix because of those very reasons. Even if tech companies implement the proposed solutions, which is unlikely, the root problem still remains, and it will still manifest itself. Full-time employees face issues too, of an entirely different nature, but the same root cause. In 2016, Intel announced a layoff and restructuring process that would stretch into 2017, something not entirely unusual for a company. What is unusual is that Intel is under investigation for age discrimination within these layoffs. Intel maintains that factors such as age, race, national origin, gender, immigration status, or other personal demographics were not part of their process. And yet, the Wall Street Journal's review of Intel's own internal documents reveals that the median age for the layoffs was 49 years old, 7 years older than the median age of the remaining staff.
The action in 2016, even though they went to extreme measures to try to say it wasn't age, just based on age, many of the situations they used to do it was based on age. If you were ready to retire, Intel gave you a big bonus to retire. And I won't get into the details of the bonus, but it's like a depending on how long you'd work there. You'd work there as long as I have, you know, it's a big bonus, right, to get you to retire early. And so that aspect clearly targeted older people. But there was also something else in that 2016 reduction where they used a award mechanism inside the company in terms of what kind of, how much stock were given to the employees as a means of letting people go. When that specific mechanism was never ever intended by anyone to be used as something to say how well the employee was doing. So the employees that had this lower value of this lower stock rating, even if they were very successful employees, they had this lower value of stock rating for whatever reason. There could be several reasons why they did it. Those got let go involuntarily, meaning they got forced out. And it was not based on what the managers wanted them to do. It was based at the top down at the corporate level. And so there were many very valuable employees that got pushed out right then that was just plain stupid. I think if you looked at it, you'd find that people who had been there a long time may have been lower on that value, because sometimes when a company gives stock options to people, gives stock to people, it gives it to them trying to get them to stay another 5 or 10 years. And if somebody's 60, you know they're not going to stay 5 or 10 more years. So you don't necessarily give them that higher value. And so that the metric they used, this how much stock was been given in the future to force people out, even though they denied it, I think it was a little bit of an age discrimination. And if you look at it, there were more older people who got pushed out through that mechanism than younger people. They didn't even let them go back to their office. They were, when they entered the building, they were told they were being let go. They couldn't even go to their office. Somebody else had to collect their stuff. Their email account was immediately shut off. They couldn't even email goodbye to people. I think it was just a complete screw up. I think what they did was just completely wrong. It caused tremendous ill will among the employees that remained. Tremendous ill will. Me, for example, after that action, my loyalty to Intel went to zero. The only reason I stayed for that extra year and a half was not for Intel, but because of the specific individuals I was working with, I wanted to help them. The people who were let go or who were encouraged to retire via this retirement package incentive, the ones that were voluntary, you know, if people have to go and you can get people to leave that want to leave, and you essentially pay them to leave, it was good. It's just how it got done left a bitter taste in everybody's mouth. The details, the financial side for those who were let go was very good. And so when you look at Intel, they got part of it right and part of it way wrong. Even though they were financially well taken care of, how it was done, how they were selected, and how they physically did it on the day of left an extreme bitter taste in everybody's mouth. I think both of those issues will continue, and sometimes they're abused and sometimes they're not abused. And it's not even the company, it's who's making the decisions right then.
Ultimately, these are problems that stem from an insolvable source, the inconsistencies of corporate decisions. Something that cannot be solved by any reasonable amount of government policy or public action. Rather, we must trust companies to act in their own best interest, and hire competent leaders who make decisions on behalf of both themselves and their employees. The tech industry has revolutionized how we live our lives, but it has also ruined those of its workers. And the apparent solution is no solution at all. If things are to really, truly change, greater awareness is the first step. For KBOO News, I'm Ethan Fry. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 19th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Amara Moore, Claire Ricciotto, and Alex Connor. The producer is Aletha Bellings, and our engineer is Geoff Henderson. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Aletha Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Fry.
And I'm Ken Jones. Stay tuned for KBOO's News in Depth. We'll be talking with Ron Brister and Mikey Nielsen live in our KBOO studios about the upcoming Rose City Comic Con.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our in-depth guests tonight are Ron Brister and Mikey Nielsen of Rose City Comic Con. Ron's the founder and director, Mikey's the programming director, and Rose City Comic Con, well, that just happens to be one of the biggest pop culture events in the Pacific Northwest. Now in its eighth year, Rose City Comic Con's primary focus is on comics and comic creators, and Portland's blessed to be a hotbed of both. But the event also includes gaming, sci-fi, cosplay, anime, and fantasy, and features celebrity guests from the world of movies, animation, TV, books, and art. Rose City Comic Con takes place this year from Friday, September 13th through Sunday, September 15th at the Oregon Convention Center, and we're fortunate to have Ron and Mikey live with us now in the KBOO studios to give us a preview. Ron Brister and Mikey Nielsen, thanks so much for coming into KBOO. Yeah,
thanks for having us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ron, let's start with you. You started Rose City Comic Con. The first one was back in 2012. And from what I've read, we have your son to thank for all this. He was about 11 at the time.
Yeah, I think he was 10 or 11, and we were at San Diego, in San Diego, for San Diego Comic-Con.
Which is huge, right?
Massive. More massive than it was then, even, as a matter of fact.
150,000 people, I think.
Something ridiculous like that. Yeah. And on our drive home, you know, he asked a simple question because we'd gone to Emerald City. We'd gone to all these other events. And he said, how come we don't have a Comic-Con in Portland? And I said, I don't know. I have 21 hours to think about it. So as I drove home, I formulated just a maniacal plan in my head, I guess. And the rest is history. Here we are.
Now, you were a fan of comics, of course. You were at Comic-Con in San Diego, but your day job was in high tech.
Yep.
How did you start putting all this together? Was that something going through your head during those 21 hours on the way home?
You know, I think that I knew that I needed to do something creative because I was so massively bored of my day job. So this was, and I can't write, I can't draw, but I can organize things. So I figured, why not put that skill to use?
Now, the first convention in 2012 exceeded expectations and
Correct.
Apparently capacity.
Yeah.
That was at the Lloyd Center DoubleTree Hotel. Mm-hmm. I read you were hoping for about 750 paying customers. That would allow you to break even.
Yep.
But the fire marshal cut you off at 4,100?
4,100 was the capacity we reached finally when they said you can't let anybody else in the building. I needed 750 people until I bought a three-hole punch, and I needed 751 people to break even. So we exceeded that. We exceeded the plan that first year.
Mission wasn't very much at the time.
No, it wasn't very much, but yeah, three-hole punch kind of put us over the limit.
How'd you get the word out? That was 2011, so social media wasn't what it is now.
Yeah, I mean, it was really – social media was picking up at that point in time, but I think that for us, being such a strong comics community in Portland, having – you know, people that, I mean, at the time, Mikey was more of a fan and now he's part of the team. He came to us and said, oh, I want to be involved. What can I do to help promote? He was running a really popular podcast at the time. So we got with him. We got with other like-minded folks around town and everybody just helped spread the word. You know, a lot of things that show up in Portland really grow kind of organically in this town, which is nice. And then you get to a certain point where we are now. And of course, we pay for advertising because we have to, you know, reach the outer markets, you know, the suburbia, but it really just kind of grew organically and naturally. And I think people were just excited.
And that organic and natural growth is just absolutely amazing. I mean, I read you expect about 70,000 attendees this year. And there aren't that many Comic Cons in the country bigger than Portland's, is there? There's New York, San Diego, Denver, Phoenix, Seattle.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to quantify. The bigger ones, I mean, there's a great one out in Orlando. There's some great ones on the East Coast. I mean, of course, I think we're the best one.
We're the best one.
Yeah, we're definitely the best one. I'm a huge fan of Emerald City still. I'm a huge fan of, you know, I'm even a big fan of San Diego, even though it's kind of massive and too big for me at this point in time. There's a lot of great events around the country. I think we're on the West Coast. We're probably the third or fourth largest one now because you got WonderCon, you got San Diego, you got Emerald City. Those are all bigger than us right now. I think we'll pass Emerald City, though. That's my goal.
Be great.
Yeah.
we'll mention the soccer aspect of it
exactly,
a little later,
a rivalry.
Too. One of the events associated with the Comic-Con this year has to do with that. Now, how far ahead do you start planning for each Comic-Con? Like, when are you going to start the process for Comic-Con 2020?
We started planning 2020 and 2018. So
amazing.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. So it's been a while now. I am actually budget planning and booking guests now for 20 and 2021.
And that is a good transition because, Mikey, you're the programming director,
yeah.
And you just the event schedule actually will be out this week. You said
It should be out this
today.
Week. Yeah.
So this is great timing for us at KBOO. Let's talk about some of the guests and events. First, the local ones.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned Portland is a hotbed for the comics business, so publishers and creators. I know you have Oni Press and Dark Horse Comics represented. They're both two of the best known indie publishers of comics and graphic novels, you know, under the DCs and the Marvels. Can you tell us what they'll be offering attendees?
Yeah, Oni is actually going to be doing kind of a... they're going to be working with Greg Rucka for Stumptown, like talking about the comic, because we're going to have that show coming out soon. So they're going to be having a whole showcase on the comic.
And Greg is local.
Yeah, and Greg is local. We have David Walker is going to be talking about his Eisner-nominated comic, Bitter Root. He'll be working with Image on that. We're just going to have so many different local creators that are right here that are, you know, making some pretty big waves and not just comics, but television and everything like that.
Yeah, I had those two down, David Walker and Greg Rucker, but also Matt Fraction.
Yes.
And his wife, Kelly
Sudikonik,
who's been at previous.
Mm-hmm. Kelly Sudikonik's going to be talking a lot about Pretty Deadly, which is one of her creator-owned books, as well as Matt's going to be talking about, you know, all the great stuff that Matt's doing. They have some TV projects also in the works that I'm sure will be brought up at some point in the conversation.
So kind of this little homegrown comics industry has now become major media with, well, maybe not movies yet, but certainly television with Stumptown and
And really it always has since the 80s. It's just now with the success of all the Marvel movies and the DC movies, you know, there's a bigger spotlight on what comics can be in the bigger media spotlight. But, you know, really this has been where all the great ideas have been coming from for the last two or three decades.
Now, Brian Michael Bendis won't be there this year, but he's been at previous Comic-Cons.
Yes.
And he does work for Marvel?
He's working for DC now.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So he's kind
of... But he was with Marvel for almost two decades.
Ah.
Yeah.
But he's one of the biggest names in comics nationwide, worldwide.
And one of the nicest guys in the industry, too. Yeah.
Yeah, I know he teaches actually a course on comics at Portland State.
I took his class.
Wow.
Yeah.
I read the book.
Yeah.
So. Now, in addition to the local luminaries, you have guests coming from all over the world. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know if you could name a few you're especially looking forward to seeing. I have one first. Weird Al Yankovic will be there, who's not from the world of comics, but he's a very funny guy.
Yeah.
Did you see him this last week?
No, I didn't get a chance. Yeah. Yes, he was at Edgefield. Did you go?
Yeah, I went. Yeah, it was. I have to admit, I've never been to a Weird Al show.
Oh.
And that was one of the most entertaining things that I've ever
seen.
They're fun. Yeah, so.
Yeah, yeah, I went to one with my kids when they were younger. Yeah. It's just perfect.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
We were lucky to have Al 2 years ago, and at that point, he never really had done shows, like many comic conventions or anything like that. And so it was him dipping his foot into this world a little bit, and he loved it. And so we're excited to have him back because, you know, he was a hit for everybody that met him. So now everybody that didn't get the chance is going to get the chance again, which I highly recommend you don't miss it.
Yeah, I think he's the hardest working guy that we've ever had in the celebrity area because he didn't leave his signing station for basically 2 days.
Yeah, only for his panel. Yeah, only for his panel did he really ever leave.
What was his panel on? Was it on song parodies?
No, just him talking about his career.
Yeah. Oh, people. So our panels, the way they're structured is it's about 40 to 50 minutes, this kind of free form, and we have Stephanie Strickland. She used to be on air here in town.
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
So she moderates, and what she really does is she keeps the conversation moving. She has a couple of questions that she'll ask and get things going. But then really, we give it up to the audience to ask questions because they're the ones who paid to be there to see the celebrity. So we spend the most of the time letting them ask questions and have them answered by the talent on stage.
So the attendees will get a chance not only to see celebrity guests, especially ones they want to see, they're coming to see in the panels, but also there's opportunities at booths, there's signings and photo opportunities?
That's correct.
How did they learn about that?
So obviously on our website we have all that listed out as far as what guests are coming, what day they're going to be available, autograph schedules, photo op schedules, and also pricing because, you know, the celebrities do charge because it's really kind of a pay-to-play scenario.
Oh, definitely, so, and that has nothing to do with you guys.
No, it has nothing to do with us. So I always just like to tell everybody, but if you want to see a celebrity or you want to have a chance to talk to a celebrity, you can always go to their Q&A session, which there's no additional charge for that. Everybody's welcome to that. We have a room that's got about 3,000 seats. People sit down, and they can line up and ask, you know, whatever question they have on their mind. We don't pre-screen them. Of course, you know, if it's something that isn't appropriate, it'll probably be asked. Yeah. They probably won't answer.
The shepherd's crook might come up. Yeah.
I'm sure they're used to dealing with that.
They are. They're very good at kind of, you know, navigating those types of things. Mm-hmm. But by and large, it's, you know, it's not. I would say that when people get up there and they're asking questions, and this is just a fun family event for a lot of folks. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you see multiple generations. With Weird Al, you'll see probably three generations show up together, you know, grandma, family, mom,
young
and dad.
Audience.
Yeah, exactly. So we expect a lot of families, so it'll be pretty wholesome.
I mean, not to mention just all the great stuff around the reunions that we're doing this year, too. We're going to have three people from Princess Bride, you know, coming to the show.
Shawn is Carrie Elwes.
Yeah. We have the Goofy movie cast, Bill Farmer and
Pauly Shore, Jason Martin.
The Office.
The Office.
You've got at least three actors from The Office, right? Mm-hmm.
They're coming out to do an audit, you know, check the books.
No, and then, you know, like you mentioned, we have Billy Piper and Christopher Eccleston coming from Doctor Who, you know. So,
by the way, that's his first U.S. appearance ever, Chris Eccleston. This will be the first time he's ever come on U.S. soil for a convention appearance. It'll be at Portland. So it's a pretty big flag we're planting on the convention map.
How'd you get him?
I begged him for 3 years.
It was a long process.
It took about 3 years.
And that's not an exaggeration. No. It's literally been 3 years we've been trying to get him out here.
No, I should mention some of the other guests there. Yeah. Well, Neil Adams from the world of comics. Mm-hmm. You've got Hercules and the Hulk there. So Kevin Sorbo and Lou Ferrigno.
Yep.
Yep.
We mentioned Cary Elwes, but also Anthony Michael Hall, Robert Englund, who was Freddy Krueger in Nightmare on Elm Street movies. Tim Curry from Rocky Horror Picture Show. Will Wheaton, who does a lot of Comic Cons.
Yep.
Jason Isaacs, who was in the Harry Potter movies. And then, of course, we mentioned Christopher Eccleston, the big draw this year for Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think out of all those two, you know, I've met Anthony Michael Hall and the Weird Science cast, and they're lovely. So if you're a fan of John Hughes or the 80s films or anything like that, this is going to be a great...
And Kelly LeBrock.
Yeah, Kelly LeBrock will be there. I don't know anybody in the 80s who did not have a crush on Kelly LeBrock.
Lovely today as she was back then.
Yeah.
So I got to ask, since you worked on Chris Eccleston for like 3 years, is there anybody currently on your bucket list that you're working on?
Michael Keaton.
Wow. So Beetlejuice and among other things, Batman movies.
Yeah.
And,
I'm thinking Mr. Mom and Gung Ho. Those are the movies I like that he was in. But yeah.
He did so many great ones.
He did so many good ones.
Are you in the process then? Have you contacted?
You know, I'm always on a fishing expedition, seeing what I can get caught in the net. But right now, nothing's, you know, I haven't reeled them in yet. But we'll see.
And a lot of it has to do with people's schedules too. You know, people are filming all the time, and our show is sometimes right when they're filming. So sometimes it's just a timing thing. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned it's family friendly.
Absolutely.
You actually have a whole section devoted to younger folks, actual kids, as opposed to grown up kids like myself.
Yeah.
And that's called Rose City Junior. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah. We noticed when our kids were young that we were going to a lot of conventions and there was nothing for our kids to do because it was really geared towards 25 to 45 year old males, is what, you know, I found kind of in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so when we started having kids and we decided we wanted to do a Comic-Con, we decided we were going to have an area dedicated to them. First year that we did it, which was in year two, we dedicated about 5,000 square feet, which wasn't a lot, but we didn't have a lot of room at the time. And it's continued to grow. We now use about 30,000 square feet. It's completely programmed by somebody dedicated to children's programming. We work with a lot of youth organizations. We work with the Toy Association, which is a trade show organization for the toy industry. We've partnered with the LeakyCon folks who are putting together Harry Potter programming that's geared towards that age group. So I think all weekend long, you know, the kids are going to have a great time. There's Trackers Earth, which is a local company that puts on summer camps and winter camps, you know, during school breaks. It's coming out and putting on a rock wall and all kinds of
I saw that on the website. Yeah. The other thing I saw recently on your Facebook page, it might have been today, you have a Bigfoot scavenger hunt planned for the Rose City Junior people.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's little things like that where once you're in the door, it doesn't cost you anything else to really participate and gain an experience that you may not get someplace else. I mean, so sure, mom and dad are there because they want to see some celebrities, but the kids don't really care about celebrities, so we have to have something for them to do. So we got video gaming, we got retro arcades, we got classic tabletop gaming. You can go to the game library. You and your family can look at a game that you haven't learned how to play yet, and there'll be somebody there to demo it for you. You can take it to a table, learn how to play it, and decide, oh, I like this game. Maybe I'll buy from Amazon. Maybe I'll buy from a retailer out there on the show floor.
And when it comes to programming, we have all kinds of things for every single type of person. So we're having a whole track that's dedicated to people who are into tabletop and role-playing games, cosplay, you know, education, if you're looking to learn more about just actual professional educators from universities coming and talking about studying in comics. Whatever you're there for, you're going to find something.
And I did mention a little earlier about the soccer connection.
Yeah, yeah.
You actually have Portland Thorns Night, Rose City Comic Con Night at the Thorns game.
Yep.
The Wednesday right before.
Yeah, that's right. And it's the rematch of the championship game from last year.
North Carolina
against the Thorns. We're going to beat them. So it's going to be a great night.
There's no question.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, and with Women's World Cup, I mean, we have some of the top players in Women's World Cup here in Portland. It's a great time.
Tobin Heath.
Oh, yeah.
Lindsay Horan.
Yep. Uh-huh. It's going to be a great night for families to come out, especially anybody who's coming in from out of town that maybe is getting here a couple days early, even exhibitors and artists. They'll have an opportunity to hang out and relax before the show weekend, you know, which can get pretty busy for them. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a good time. Hopefully it's not raining, but it doesn't really matter because soccer gets played in the rain, so it'll be fun.
And a lot of Providence Park is covered. I should mention that.
Yeah, these days.
My wife and I are actually season ticket holders for the Timbers. So.
Oh, yeah. Me too. All right. Yeah.
Now, I should mention that that particular ticket package also includes an exclusive Comic-Con and Thorns t-shirt, which is going to be a collector's item, I'm sure.
Yeah, we're
You'll
only...
You'll see them on eBay.
Yeah, well, maybe, yeah. We're only producing, 500... shirts, because basically we're selling 500 tickets right now, and so those shirts are, I think they're great. They're designed by one of the artists. It'll be in our artist alley too, so you can always bring the shirt in and get it signed by Levi Hastings, who also did our mascot. So yeah.
Well, I actually have more questions, but we're kind of out of time.
No
There's
worries.
Just so much about this incredible event, and it is massive, it's huge, but it's family friendly, as you mentioned. It's for everybody, kids and kids of all ages, as they used to say at the circus. Ron and Mikey, I know it's a very busy time for you with Comic-Con coming up in a few weeks, so many thanks to taking time out and joining us at KBOO this afternoon.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Ron Brister, founder and director, and Mikey Nielsen, programming director of Rose City Comic-Con. Rose City Comic-Con takes place this year from Friday, September 13th through Sunday, September 15th at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland, not too far from KBOO. You can find out all the details and how to get your tickets on their website, rosecitycomiccon.com, and on Facebook under, of course, Rose City Comic-Con. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
Michael Barton, a person with a history of mental illness and obvious dementia, died in the Oregon State Penitentiary after catching what seemed to be a simple case of the flu. As his condition worsened, nurses and medical staff at the prison repeatedly dismissed his pleas for help. While the Department of Corrections review of Mr. Barton's death called it a systems failure, Disability Rights Oregon concluded that part of that system failure was attributable to a nursing and medical culture that dismiss the needs of patients with disabilities. Join me on Prison Pipeline as we discuss the investigation of the death of Michael Barton. That's Prison Pipeline, August 19th at 6:30 p.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
To you, the all-night driver,